Morning, Faith Church. It's good to be here today. I always enjoy coming in. It's always dangerous to have me come in, too. You never know what I'm going to say or how I'm going to do the sermon. I think last time I preached through an entire book of the Bible, and we had a good time. This Sunday, what I'm doing today is really for me. It's not for you. You just happen to be here. December is my birthday month. December is also Christmas, and tomorrow is my wedding anniversary, so I thought I'd give myself a gift by talking about what I want to talk about this morning. This is something I like to do every year if I have the opportunity. This topic is something I like to do every year if I have the opportunity, and I didn't quite get to do it with my students over at Pacific Islands University, so you're going to have to suffer along with me this morning. As I talk about, where was Jesus born? A very familiar passage. If you have your Bibles, open up to Luke chapter 2, and I will be looking at the nativity story, kind of as a year-in-review sort of thing. This is New Year's Eve. We're supposed to today look back on what we've done over the previous year and look forward into next year and decide how we're going to live our lives next year. And this is my kind of year in review for how did we celebrate Christmas. I'm going to look back over the ways we do our nativity scenes and our nativity plays, and then I'm going to give you some of my own perspective and insights into maybe some ways we could do it a little bit more accurately to the biblical text. Sound good? I got one nod of approval, so I'm going to take it as everyone gets to go along with me. Let me pray, and then I'm going to jump right into it. Almighty God, Father, Jesus, Holy Spirit, we are so grateful that you have come to be one of us. That you have made a way for us to join into your big family. That you give us celebrations through the year to remind us of those big moments in the story that you are creating along with us in this world. Help us this morning to get a deeper glimpse into some of these familiar stories and to take these with us into the coming year so that we can love you and love one another all the better. We ask this in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Oh, I've got a clicker. I've got pictures today. Let me see if this thing works. Yeah, okay, it does work. I got power. Very nice. Luke chapter 2. Here's my question to you. How do you picture this scene? How did you set up your nativity scene this year? And how did you do your nativity plays? Look at this picture and think about it. I'm going to read you Luke chapter 2. When you follow along and do the best you can to bring into your mind's eye, rebuild the image of this first Christmas day. Here it is, Luke chapter 2. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. And this was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. And she wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room, there was no room in the inn available for them. How do you picture this story? How do you tell it each year when it comes Christmas time? What do we do? Now, I'm a teacher, so when I ask questions, I like to have feedback. Otherwise, I feel like I'm doing a bad job, right? If it's just me talking all the time, I'm not really a pastor. I don't want to talk all the time. If it's just me talking all the time, I don't feel good about myself. So I do need some feedback occasionally here when I'm asking questions. I really do want feedback. So let me ask again. in the nativity scene, how do we do it? What do we picture? What are some of the elements we make sure we got to include when we set up the scene or when we do our nativity plays? What did we do this past Christmas? You need animals. You absolutely need some animals, right? And if you're at a real fancy church, you might even bring animals into your church during the Christmas time. Get a donkey in there. Maybe get a camel in there if your church has some real money, right? And the kids go crazy for the animals. Any animals that show up here in Luke chapter 2? There's no animals in Luke chapter 2, which is weird. And usually when we tell this story, we have a very specific animal we make sure we have to include in the Christmas story. What animal do we usually make sure we have to include when you tell the Christmas story? You get the sheep with the shepherds, but for the Mary and Joseph scene, what animal do you have to include? A donkey, yeah. Whoever shouted out donkey, plus 10 points to your house. Very good. A donkey, you've got to include the donkey. And sometimes we even tell the nativity story from the perspective of the donkey. And where do we get that from? It's not from Luke 2, which is weird. We do have a source. If you've never read the Proto-Gospel of James, which is an apocryphal gospel, just the nativity story, that's probably written 100, 150 years after the other gospels. That's where we get the donkey scene from. I don't know, go home and read it this afternoon. And you get some extra tradition. Not in your Bible, extra book. What else? What else? How else do we picture the nativity scene? How do we tell it? You got a manger, and what's the main? Why are they in a manger? There's no room in the inn. So you've got to have one of those scenes, right? You've got to have one of those scenes when you're doing the nativity play, where you get your Mary and Joseph, and you get the donkey, or the kid playing the donkey, right? However you want to do it in your nativity scene. And you got to walk up, and you knock on a door, and you go, any room? No, there's no room. And you go and knock on the other door. Any room? No, there's no room, right? You have to have this scene. It sets up the tension of the story. Where are Mary and Joseph going to go to have poor baby Jesus, right? You guys ever seen the 1990s romantic comedy movie Never Been Kissed? Now, I have. I watched it in theaters as a teenager in the 1990s. The best scene in the whole movie is in the climax of the film when they're doing the prom. It's a high school movie. They're doing prom in high school, and the theme of the prom is famous couples. And as the camera is panning to set the establishing shot for the prom scene, as the camera is panning, you see all the teenagers dressed as famous couples throughout history. And there's one as Mary and Joseph going from table to table in the prom. Is there any room at this table? No, there's no room. No room at the table. No room. I laughed so hard in theaters when I saw it. I was the only one. We need more Bible literacy in this world. It was a funny joke. It was a funny joke. And you need that scene. And it's that scene that I want to focus on this morning so that next year when Christmas comes around, maybe we can tell this with a bit more historical force behind it. You ready? Okay, good. Me too. How do you picture this scene? We just said, very good. Mary and Joseph, the donkey, you're going around, room to room, building to building, knock, knock, knock. Is there any room? No, there's no room. Knock, knock, knock. Is there any room? No, there's no room. And then they find a cave or a stable somewhere, depending on your telling of it. And there they go, and you have the nativity scene. And who's there in the nativity scene? Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus, and a donkey. Maybe a cow and a sheep, if your church really has money to spring for all the animals to bring into the nativity scene. That's how we picture this scene. But I'm here to disappoint you this morning. That's what I really want to do this morning. I want you to be disappointed with how your year went and how you celebrated Christmas, because I'm here to tell you, you did it wrong. But we can improve in the next year. We can improve in our nativity scene. There are a few problems with the way we traditionally picture this scene in Luke chapter 2. There are a few problems with the way we do the nativity scene. And problem number one has to do with the very words that are used in our text. You guys know that the Bible wasn't written to you? It's written for you. You're supposed to read it. It's supposed to be for you as a gift to change your life as you go through it. It's supposed to be a place that's for you to find that revelation of who your God is, to reveal to you who God is and change your heart from the inside out. The Bible is for you, but it's not written to you. It's written to another people in another time, in another place, with a different culture and different assumptions about the world and a different language. If it was written to you, it would be written in your own language. And the Bible is, it's not written originally in English or Chamorro or Kosrayan or Chukis or any of these things. You guys know what the original language of the Bible was? I did want feedback. This is me testing you, right? What language was the Bible originally written in? You got Hebrew for the Old Testament, except for a smattering of Aramaic here and there, a little bit in Daniel, which is weird because it just switches languages right in the middle of a sentence. And then a little Aramaic in Ezra and Nehemiah. And then you have Greek in the New Testament. And our New Testament story here in Luke chapter 2 was written in Greek, which means when we tell the story in English, when we tell the story in our nativity plays, we have to do a bit of translation. And as translators know, you have to make choices. I'm looking at Peter. As translators know, you have to make choices when moving from one language to another because not all languages are created equal. Not all languages have all the same kind of terms and assumptions. And when it comes to Luke chapter 2, there's one word in particular that may trip us up as we try to tell the nativity story. And it's this word right here in Luke chapter 2, verse 7. She gave birth to her firstborn son. She wrapped him in cloth and placed him in a manger because there was no room in the inn? In the guest room? The Greek word is this one right here, which I've helpfully for you put in Greek and had the English transliteration there. In the katalima, right? The U makes an I sound because of the Uification. Come take my Greek course and I'll tell you all about it, right? There was no room in the katalima. What's a katalima? You don't need to answer that. I'm about to tell you what one of these things is. A lot of our translations and a lot of our tradition translates this as an inn. There's no room in the inn. And so we get the scene of Mary and Joseph with the donkey going door to door. Hey, can we stop here? No, you can't. Hey, can we stop here? No, you can't. Hey, can we stop here? No, you can't. There's a barn. Go to the barn. This is where we get it from this translation of this word as inn. But there's a problem with translating this as inn. This word is only used two other places in the New Testament. Now, if you want to know what a word means, how do you find out what a word means? You can open up a dictionary, but this is cheating. Don't open up a dictionary in my classroom, right? If you want to find out what a word means, you can open up a dictionary and the dictionary will tell you what it means. But there's a better way to find out what a word means. The better way to find out, is this true, Peter? The better way to find out what a word means is to look at all the places where a word is used and try to figure out the meaning of that word through the context of its usage. Is this right, Peter? He says yes, thank you. He's our translator. He's our resident translator. Is it good? All right, thank you. I got the approval thumbs up. Don't just look at a dictionary because the dictionary is doing that kind of work for you. If you want to know what a word means, go look at all the other uses of the word and figure it out in context. That'll give you the most sure meaning of the word. We've got a problem here, though. There's only two other places in the New Testament where this word is ever used. And this is Mark 14 and Luke 22. Any Bible scholars in this room that have did their sword drills in Awana good enough that you know what's in Mark 14 or Luke 22? No, me neither. I had to look it up. The chapter and verses are difficult to keep in mind. Mark 14 and Luke 22 are the same story. It's the story of the Last Supper. The Last Supper is the other place where this katalima is mentioned. And how do we tell the story of the Last Supper? Jesus says to his disciples, go into Jerusalem, When you're there, you're going to find a man and tell him, we're going to use your house to have a special meal before I go off to get crucified. And what part of his house do they use? I did want some feedback on that one, right? We're all church people. What part of the house do they use? They use the upper room of the house. If you go to Jerusalem today, there is a spot in Jerusalem that claims to be this spot. It's still there, at least for the tourist, it's still there, right? You wander around Jerusalem, you find a nondescript front of some nondescript building, and you walk in and they go, this is the building that Jesus had his last supper in. You walk up a set of stairs, you go into the room, and there will inevitably be people there reading the scene from the Last Supper. It is a katalima, an upper room. This is the view from the katalima, the upper room that Jesus had his Last Supper in Jerusalem. I took this picture myself. I'm standing on the roof because it's got a little door that leads out to a balcony, and that's Jerusalem. That's not, oh, little town of Bethlehem. That's, oh, larger town of Jerusalem. Right there. And it's an upper room. That's what a katalima is. It's an upper room. You guys want to see the inside? Of course you do. This is the inside of it. Sorry for the fuzzy photo. That's me. Inside, you can see I'm sitting there in my Zori and my shorts. Total Guam guy just hanging out in the Jerusalem katalima. Sorry for the fuzziness of this photo. A friend of mine snapped this picture of me as I was sneaking in with the French tour group, listening to them read the Last Supper story in French, and he snapped it from across the upper room from the katalima. So when Luke uses the word katalima in the other passage, it's not an inn, it's not a hotel, it's the upper room from just a house that Jesus had his Last Supper in. There's another problem with translating katalima as inn, and that is, Luke has another word for a legitimate inn, for a hotel. It shows up in the story of the Good Samaritan, a story only Luke tells. You remember that story? Good Samaritan, it's a parable that Jesus tells. There's a guy traveling down from Jerusalem, and as he's traveling down, he gets beat up and robbed, and then one holy guy passes by and doesn't do anything, and another holy guy passes by and doesn't do anything, and then the Samaritan, a not holy guy, passes by and takes the guy and puts him on it. There's a donkey in that story. Puts him on his donkey and then takes him to, you remember this story? Takes him to an inn and says, care for this guy. I will give you money to put him up, put him in a room, take care of him. And if there's any extra he has to pay on the bill, I will come back and pay that too. Luke tells this story and he actually mentions the inn in the Good Samaritan story. And in that story, he does not use the term katalima. Instead, he uses the term pandokion. He takes him, es pandokion, into the inn and he pays for his room there. So how do you translate the word in Luke chapter 2? In the other usages of the word katalima, it's not an inn, it's an upper room on a house. And then when Luke talks about an inn, he's got a totally different word for it. So what do we do with our nativity scenes? Problem number one was the problem of the word, the term itself. Problem number two with our traditional understanding of the nativity scene is the land, Bethlehem itself. We sang the song this morning, O Little Town of Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is in fact a little town, or it was a little town back during the time that Jesus was born in it. So little, in fact, that there is no archaeological evidence for there being an inn in Bethlehem. No hotel in Bethlehem from the ancient world all the way up to the time of Jesus and a bit beyond. There's a hotel in Bethlehem now. It's a tourist destination, right? That's a nativity scene inside of a hotel in Bethlehem today. That's a Banksy. You guys know Banksy, the graffiti artist? This is Banksy's nativity scene. The background of Banksy's nativity scene is supposed to be the dividing wall that separates the Palestinian territory from Israelite territory. And the star up above there is a bullet hole through the wall, which is the only political statement I'm making this morning. I don't know what it means, but there you go. Bethlehem has an inn today, but ancient Bethlehem was too small of a town, and there's no archaeological evidence for an inn. There's no hotel in Bethlehem. So what do we do with our scene? They can't be going around from hotel to hotel. Is there any room in the Hyatt? No, there's no room in the Hyatt. Any room in the Hilton? No, there's no room in the Hilton. Any room in the Disset? No, there's no room in the Disset, Tommy, right? Because those don't exist in Bethlehem. So where is there no room? Where is Jesus born? Problem number three. First problem is the problem of the word. The word doesn't quite mean hotel. Problem number two is the problem of the space. Bethlehem is little. It doesn't have a hotel. The third problem is the problem of the reason behind why Mary and Joseph are in Bethlehem in the first place. Why are Mary and Joseph in Bethlehem in the first place? The census. Very good. What's a census? You're counting people, right? And it's the census that the Roman government is counting the people, seeing how many they are and what they have. Why is the Roman government counting the people? It's money, thank you. It's taxes. This is for tax purposes, right? All right, everyone. We're going to count you all, and we're going to count what stuff you have so we know how much we, the government, get to take away from you, right? This is what they're doing. Here's the verse again. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This is the first census when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee, in Judea, where he was, to Bethlehem, to the town of David, because he belonged to a family whose land was in Bethlehem. This brings up the question, who lived in Bethlehem? I'm letting that sink in. Everyone's feeling the weight, the heaviness of this question. Because we've been telling the nativity story as if Mary and Joseph get up all by themselves and go to a town where they've got no place to stay, and so they have to stay at a hotel. But what's the reason they're in Bethlehem in the first place? They're in Bethlehem in the first place because the Roman government told them, you and all your brothers and sisters and your cousins need to go back to Grandma and Grandpa's house so we can count how many people are in which family and who belongs to this ancestral plot of land. So who lives in Bethlehem? Joseph's family lives in Bethlehem. And according to the census, where is Joseph supposed to go to get counted? He's supposed to go to Grandma and Grandpa's house. So if you, this Christmas, celebrated Christmas by going off to your family's house, that's the real traditional way to do it, because that's how Mary and Joseph and Jesus did it the very first Christmas. They're not going around trying to find an inn. They have to go to Bethlehem, according to the Roman government, to go back to Grandma and Grandpa's house to be counted. And who can you expect to be there? All the rest of the family that needs to go back to get counted. All the cousins, all the aunts, all the uncles, right? All the third uncles, twice removed, maybe, I don't know. That weird uncle who doesn't normally hang around, I mean, it's government purposes. He's got to go there to be taxed, right? Who lives in Bethlehem? The family lives in Bethlehem. But I hear you saying, wait. I like my traditional understanding of the Christmas nativity scene. I mean, all the nativity sets in my house match the traditional one that we've been doing year after year. Don't tell me it's wrong. I don't want to change them. Let me find a reason for keeping Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus alone in a manger, right? We don't want all the cousins there. And you say, no, see, Mike, Mary was pregnant out of wedlock. And so the family, being traditional, was a little iffy about Mary being there. And maybe Mary and Joseph weren't on best of terms with the grandma and grandpa and mom and dad and all the cousins, so they had to find a place in a hotel before they sprung it on them. Hi, Mom and Dad. It's me, Joseph. This is my soon-to-be, not-yet-wife, Mary. And tell us congratulations. We're pregnant. Right? Oh, no, don't do that. Right? So they have to go around and find the inn. But what do we know about Mary and Joseph's family from the rest of the story? Because they show up in the rest of the story. Luke. If you start in chapter 1 instead of just chapter 2, what you find is that Mary was on good terms with her family. Mary was on good terms with her family. The whole of Luke opens up with a scene about Mary and Elizabeth. They're family and they like one another. And when they find out that Mary is pregnant, what does Elizabeth do? She doesn't get mad and say, oh, you can't stay here with us. You got to go to a hotel. You know, you're getting pregnant out of wedlock. No, no, no. She sings a song. She gives a great prayer, which inspires Mary to give a great prayer too, the Magnificat. By the way, if you want some extra homework over this New Year's Eve, and you want to go back and review your Christmas story, Luke chapter 1 is a great place to do it. All kinds of interesting things going on in Luke chapter 1. But don't read Luke chapter 1 by itself. Compare and contrast it with the beginning of Samuel. Beginning of Samuel. This is my special bonus. This is my real gift here. I don't really want to talk about Christmas. I want to talk about the Old Testament. Samuel Kings, what's Samuel Kings about? The books of Samuel Kings in your Old Testament, the books of Samuel and Kings are about kings. They're about heroes. They're about mighty men. And the author that begins the book about kings and heroes and mighty men in your Old Testament, he begins it with a story about a woman who needs to get pregnant, who wants to get pregnant. Before he tells David and Goliath, before he tells Saul killing the Philistines, before he tells Elijah and Elisha to set up the story of all the great manly heroes of your Old Testament, he begins with a story about a lady who just wants to get pregnant. Hannah. And when God finally gives Hannah a baby, what does Hannah do? She sings. She sings a prayer just like Mary sings a prayer when she meets Elizabeth. This is not a mistake. The author of Luke is playing off ideas that started back in Samuel Kings. Samuel Kings is a book about kings that begins with the story of a woman who wants to get pregnant. And Luke is a book about the ultimate king that begins with the story of a woman who wants to get pregnant. The parallels are there, and they're important. Yeah, for homework. Go read them side by side, and then find me at Pacific Islands University and come talk to me for 3 hours about what you saw there. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Mary was on good terms with her family. What about Joseph? If you continue to read the story in Luke chapter 2, you will find that Joseph was also on good terms with his family. The Luke chapter 2 story continues on, and you get the story of young boy Jesus at the temple. This is how Luke chapter 2 ends. You remember this scene? This is a picture of young boy Jesus hanging out at the temple. I like this picture because young boy Jesus looks like he could be my cousin. He didn't really look like that, right? Jesus looks like this in all the pictures because the pictures are drawn by European guys who used other European guys as the models. Apparently my cousin as the model, right? You remember the scene? Jesus is 12 years old now at the end of Luke chapter 2, and they take him to the temple for the festivities, for the festivals, and then the family, once the festivals are done, they leave the temple and they're all going back to their homes, but where is little boy Jesus? He's not with the family traveling. He stayed behind in the temple. And the family travels for some time before they realize, boy, Jesus is not with them. And why does the family travel for some time before they realize little boy Jesus is not with them? Because they assume he's just with other members of the family. Who are Mary and Joseph traveling with at the end of Luke chapter 2? They're traveling with aunts and uncles and cousins and all the rest of the family. And they are on such good terms that they go for over a day without seeing Jesus going, oh, he's probably with his uncle. No problem, right? They're on good terms with the family. The family is there in the story, and it should be there in your nativity play as well. Problem number one is the problem of the word. What does Katalima mean? Not an inn. Luke's got another word for that. Problem number two was the size of Bethlehem. Is there an inn in Bethlehem? There's not an inn archaeologically in Bethlehem. It's too small. Problem number three is the problem, the reason why they're in Bethlehem in the first place. They're there for the census, and they need to be counted along with family. And so they need to stay on family land. Problem number four with our traditional scene of the nativity is the medical problem. The medical problem. Mary's pregnant, and she gives birth in this scene. Who is supposed to help a lady give birth? We live in a modern age. I've got four kids. And Samantha, you were pregnant four times? At least four times. And you gave birth these four times. And who was there to assist you? You had the doctors, you had the nurses, and you had me. I was not any help. I passed out all four times. Every single kid I passed out at. They made me cut the umbilical cord on three of them. I tried to decline. The last time they said, oh, you, the father, you're here. You've been helping in the room the whole time. Cut this umbilical cord. I said, no, I'm going to pass out. And they just put the scissors down on the table and said, well, we're not going to do it. So if you don't do it, no one's going to do it. I said, all right, but I'm going to pass out. I said, no, you'll be fine. I picked up the scissors. I cut the... Birth is gross, y'all. If you've never watched, it's gross. There's blood, there's fluids. It's nasty, right? And I cut that umbilical cord, and this sploosh of blood came. Oh, so gross. This sploosh of blood came out, and I passed out. I saw it, and I'm going to fall. And I fell and passed out. I woke up a bit later, and the nurse, are you okay? I said, yeah, I told you I was going to pass out. Don't make me do it again, right? But it's true. I wish we lived in ancient times where when a woman gave birth, the men were nowhere around, right? The men wisely said, this is gross. I'm not going to look at that. I'm going somewhere else. In the ancient world, men do not help a woman give birth. That's a modern phenomenon where the man goes into the waiting room. I mean, even back 50 years ago, men didn't really go into the birthing room and help their wives give birth. You stayed out in the waiting room and smoked cigars with your buddies. And, you know, you listen to the screams of pain from the ladies and go, they're doing a good job. Yeah, blessings on women, all women. I'm sorry. But in the ancient world, the men were nowhere to be found when you had to deliver a baby. Who do you get in the ancient world to deliver a baby? All the women of the household. This is a little ancient emblem of a birth scene. And who do you have in this birth scene? You've got mom sitting in the chair, the birthing chair, and she's pregnant. And in front of her, on the birthing stool, you have the midwife, also a lady. And behind her, you've got grandma. Grandma's there to help. Not dad, not the uncles, not the brothers. It's all the women. And you usually did it in your house. You call the midwife over. You call all the female relations over, and you kick all the men out, praise be to God, you kick all the men out, and the women do the whole thing, and then once it's all done and cleaned up, then you invite the men back in, you go, oh, it's a baby, look at that, very nice. When we tell our nativity story, we seem to skip over the gory details of the birth scene, and we tend to just have Mary and Joseph there. And as an ancient historian, I can tell you, it's a very odd thing to picture Joseph helping Mary deliver the baby. In fact, in old tellings, not in your Bible, but other old tellings, let's go back to the proto-gospel of James. When it tells it, a miracle happens in that story. That's also where we get a cave from. Mary and Joseph are traveling to Bethlehem in the proto-evangelion of James. Not in your Bible. Extra book written 100 years later. Not historically factual, but it sets a lot of our tradition. Mary and Joseph are traveling to Bethlehem on their donkey, which is where we get the donkey from, and they stop in a cave, which is where we get the cave from, and Joseph goes, oh no, she's going to give birth. I don't need to be here. And he goes outside to pray because he's not going to be there, and a miracle happens because a midwife just happens to be walking down the road at that point. Saying, oh, there, come into the cave. We've got a baby that is to be born. And he hangs outside the cave while Mary and the midwife deliver the baby. It's not Joseph leaning down. It's like, okay, I'm going to catch it. It's all the women of the household. The women that are there because they all have to go back to the ancestral home to be counted for the census. So where was Jesus born? I'm here to tell you this morning, there's no scene where they go from door to door of hotel to hotel and say, is there room? Can I get in? And they'll finally they get sent to a barn. No, they're going to their ancestral home, grandma and grandpa's house in Bethlehem, where all the female relations are there to help Mary give birth. So how do we fit this bit in? And she gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloth, and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the Catalima, in the upper room. How do we get all these elements into one home? Now that I've destroyed your image of the nativity scene, the rest of the sermon is here to build it back up. And this is how we build it back up. Behold, the ancient Israelite home. This is a typical ancient Israelite home. It actually goes beyond the Israelites. Other groups made this type of home as well. It's called the pillar room, or a four-story room, even though it's not four stories and it doesn't have four stories. It's separated. I don't know if you can see this because I copied it out of a textbook and it's a little fuzzy, yeah, a little impressionistic, right? But this is a typical Palestinian home, a typical Israelite home in the ancient world. And they built them like this from the Iron Age, a little before the Iron Age, into past the time that Jesus was born. And if you look at this closely, you can see you walk into the home right up there, and you walk into a hallway. And then on either side are rooms where you can store things, like your animals or your food. There's a kitchen, and then there's a ladder to go up to the second floor where you do your sleeping, or you do some of your other household activities, like where you make all your clothes. Yeah, the women in the ancient world not only had to give birth by themselves, they made everyone's clothes too, and they made it on the roofs of their houses. That's the typical home. Wait, let me give you another picture. Yeah? Okay, let me give you another picture. Good. This is a model, almost, not quite life-size model, of a typical Israelite ancient home. This is in a museum in Jerusalem, and you as a person going to the museum, you can like walk inside of it and go, hey, that's nice, look at this, right? And you can see it here. You walk in here, and as you walk in, there's spaces, there's rooms to store things, maybe even rooms to store animals, and then you can walk upstairs to the second floor, and what's the second floor called? That's right, it's the Catalima. The second floor is the upper room. First floor is for business. You keep your animals there. You keep your kitchen there. You keep everything that makes a mess up there. Second floor is for sleep and clean activities because you don't want to sleep down where the animals are. Catalima, that's for sleeping. Bottom floor, that's for storage and cooking and keeping the animals. You take the animal into the house during night because you don't want anyone. It's like parking your car inside a garage, right? You take your donkey from there, your sheep from the outside, and put them inside the house at night. And what's neat about these is that sometimes in a typical Israelite home, you would build the animal trough, the feeding bowl of the animal, right into the wall or right into the floor itself of the home. Here, we've got some ancient ruins of a Israelite home, and you can see the wall and the floor, and you can see this little donkey thing here, right? That's not a real donkey. That's just an outline of a donkey. I hope you can see that, because you can see right through it, yeah? And this is one of the techniques that archaeologists who make sites that you're supposed to, as an everyday person, come and look at. This is one of the techniques they use to show you what could be there. This is the ruins that are left. You can see the actual bricks that are left. But of course, the house would have been built up, and there would have been animals inside it. So they put the outline of things that should be there, if you were really there, to give you extra space to exercise your historical imagination. And so here we see the home, and inside the home is an animal, and the animal sits slightly down on a sunken floor, and then the floor up above has a feeding trough in it, a manger, so that when you go into a Palestinian home, when you go into an ancient Israelite home, you walk in on the same floor that the animals stand on, and then you step up to a slightly higher floor, and in that slightly higher floor, there might be food bowls for the animals. And then, if you're going to take a nap, you then, from that higher floor, climb the ladder to the second floor, where there's going to be pillows and blankets and things, and you can take a nap. Or stay overnight, if you've been called on a census by the Roman government to go back to your ancestral home, and then all your cousins and uncles and aunts will be sleeping upstairs. And if you're pregnant, you probably got there later than everyone else, so that they got all the best spots in the upper room, and you have to contend yourself with sleeping downstairs. Plus, you're going to give birth anyway, and it's dirty down there already, and they've already got means to flush out the bottom floor, but not the top floor, so you don't want to give birth upstairs where everyone's sleeping. You want to give birth downstairs where they already have the means to flush out the birth stuff from the home, along with all the animal stuff, right? So, here we go. Here's your answer. This is Mike's schematic of the typical first century house, just to give you these different levels. See, there's the side view. You walk in on the sunken floor, then you step up. There's the bowl where the animal trough is. Then you can go up to the katalima. There's the top-down view right there. So this, when you make your nativity scene for next year, when you do your nativity play for next year, you need to build one of these, right? Not just a little house when you put some sheep there and whatnot. You build a typical ancient Israelite home. You get Mary Joseph there. You get all the cousins there. You get all the aunts and uncles there. You get grandma and grandpa there. You need everyone in your church up front when you do the nativity play. Because it's not just Mary and Joseph by themselves. It's all of them. And then there's no room upstairs, because Jacob and Simeon and everyone else already took the good spots in the upstairs room, and you have to give birth anyway. So animals go down here. There's no room up there in the katalima, and Jesus is put there in the feeding trough, already built into the floor of the home, ready for the animals, but now made fit as well as this poor family could for the King of the universe. So where was Jesus born? Jesus was born in Bethlehem, royal city of the King David. But he wasn't born out in a barn behind the Hilton Hotel, not even the Hyatt, right? He was born in his family's house with his family all around him, and he didn't even get the good room upstairs. He had to be in the downstairs storage room. But here is the big question. Why does it matter? Why does slowing down and looking at Luke chapter 2 with a bit more of a historically informed perspective, why does it matter? How does this telling of the nativity story make any difference for us as we think about what it means for Jesus to come into our world? And there's many things I think you can pull out of this, but the one that really strikes me again and again as I read through Luke chapter 2 and read through other sections of the gospel is this great mystery of the incarnation. It's typical in Christmas sermons for the pastor to say something like, "And can you believe it? The whole King of the universe came down and became a human. Oh, what a wonder the incarnation is." And he didn't come in a palace. He came to poor means. He was born in a stable like some poor. Can you believe the King of the universe would give up all that authority and power to join a poor family? And that's true. You can still preach that. But I think sometimes the way we tell the nativity story, we still make Mary and Joseph look too holy, look too other, look too different, look too atypical. This is not a normal family. There they are, the holy family, sitting there, oh, holy night, all's quiet, calm baby Jesus, right? No crying he makes. They got a halo over them, over all three of them, a halo over the stable itself, angels looking down going, oh, yeah, this is nice, this is peaceful. And Mary and Joseph are not like us in this telling. Mary and Joseph is not a family like ours having to deal with the weird uncle. But if you slow down and read Luke chapter 2 with a more historically informed perspective, you find out that Mary and Joseph are a very typical family, just like us. When Jesus was incarnate, he didn't just come down into the world as a human. He came down into the world as a human with a family like we have, a family that sometimes has to get together and sleep all in the same house where your cousins take all the good beds and make you sleep on the floor in the living room. Jesus enters into true 100% everyday human life. And we want to be careful not to put Jesus and Mary and Joseph up on some pedestal far different than we are, because the whole story of Christmas, the whole story of Emmanuel, God with us, is truly about God becoming one of us. And it's about the rescue of the everyday, the rescue of the mundane, the transformation of everyday life into universe-changing events. And I think this gives me hope. I think this gives me a good way to think about your life in the coming year. The Christmas story is about love from heaven showing up in a typical family. And Jesus' message to his disciples is again and again and again, love one another. The problem with Christianity, and I do see this as a problem, the problem with Christianity is it's such a big, sweeping, epic story about the transformation of the entire cosmos, but we have to live it out in the daily. We have to live it out in the mundane. We have to act on that big cosmic story through just our typical everyday interactions with one another. And sometimes it seems like those everyday typical interactions with one another don't really mean much, don't count for much. But if we understand the Christmas story in a more historically informed way, we see that Jesus is all about those typical everyday mundane reactions and how they can be transformed into life-altering, universe-changing ways. After Jesus comes and does his ministry, is born in a family in Bethlehem, grows, teaches, dies, resurrects, ascends, and his church rises up and the apostles go out, and they make more churches, and those churches make more churches. All the apostles die, one by one, until only one of the original apostles of Jesus is left. It's Apostle John.
So the stories tell us. And John retires in Ephesus. And every Sunday at the church, the main church in Ephesus, because they've got the last remaining apostle alive in the church, they wheel John out, old man John, they call him, Presbyteros John, Presbyterian, which means old man. That's what we're a Presbyterian church here. You're an old man church. That's what Presbyterian means. It means old man. They wheel old man John out. He couldn't really walk anymore at the end of every Sunday service. And they say, Apostle John, last remaining of Jesus' apostles, do you have a word for us from Jesus today? And the story goes that every single Sunday that they pulled John out at the end of the service, he looked at the gathered church there and just said, as his sermon, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, all he said was, love one another. And they wheel him out next Sunday. John, last remaining of Jesus' apostles, do you have anything to say? Love one another, he would say, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, until the elders of the church got so upset with the apostle John that they pulled him aside after church one day and said, John, you got to come up with different material, man. You say the same thing every Sunday. Why do you give us the same sermon every single Sunday? And the story goes, John looked at the elders in the church at Ephesus and said, I tell you each Sunday to love one another because that was the command of Jesus. And if that is all you do, then you have done enough. That, to love one another, was the command of Jesus. And if that's the only thing you do, you have done enough. Christianity works out in the everyday, in the mundane, in those little acts of kindness to one another. Jesus came down and was incarnate, not in a mystical barn, not in a fancy cave with angels singing over it, but in an everyday family arguing about who gets the best blanket upstairs in the clean room. And he tells us you can too. You can come down into your typical everyday family with your typical everyday interactions and love one another and incarnate the Spirit of Jesus in your everyday life. That's part of what Luke chapter 2 is about. So next year, when you make the nativity scene here at Faith Church, I'm expecting a really big scene with a typical Israelite home here and everyone in the church signing up to be not just Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus, and some shepherds, but we need all the cousins, we need all the aunts and uncles, we need grandma and grandpa there, and there better be two people in the audience and everyone else up here playing the family of Jesus, because that is what we are. So love one another. Merry Christmas. Thank you, guys.